We'll hear argument first this morning, number 88512, Michigan versus Tyrus Lamont Harvey. Mr. Boffman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue before the Court today is whether an accused may be cross-examined with a statement taken subsequent to the assertion of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel, as that right has been construed in Michigan v. Jackson. I wish to present for the Court's consideration this morning two principal points. The first is that exclusion of evidence for impeachment purposes is an inappropriate remedy for violation of a prophylactic rule and that Jackson is such a rule. But secondly, and perhaps more fundamentally, that exclusion of evidence for impeachment purposes is also inappropriate for violation of the Sixth Amendment as it relates to custodial interrogation. And the facts, very briefly put, in this case are these. The victim in this case testified that respondent raped and beat her, causing three fractures to her left eye socket. Respondent, on the other hand, testified that the episode was essentially an agreement to exchange sex for cocaine gone wrong, and that the blows that he struck were in self-defense. Prosecutor questioned respondent about a statement that he had made after arraignment and assertion of the right to counsel. That statement came to be taken when respondent told the police officer that he wished to make another statement, but he then also said that he didn't know whether or not he should talk to his attorney. The officer stated that that would not be necessary, as his attorney would be supplied a copy of any statement that he might make. The assistant prosecutor stated that it was because of this colloquy between respondent and the attorney that she did not believe that the statement was admissible in the case in chief. However, she did argue that it was admissible for impeachment purposes, arguing that it was not involuntary.
Mr. Bauman.
Yes.
I guess you concede that there is a Sixth Amendment violation here.
Yes, the prosecutor at trial conceded that the colloquy between the respondent and the police officer rendered the statement inadmissible in the case in chief. And we are not contesting that.
When did the Sixth Amendment violation occur?
I would say that it occurred when the police officer continued to question respondent after the colloquy about whether or not he should talk to his attorney.
Is the admission of the statements at trial itself a Sixth Amendment violation or not?
Yes, the Sixth Amendment was not violated, I would say, by the taking of the statement. If the prosecutor had never used it for any purpose, there wouldn't be a violation.
You don't think there's a violation, even though he didn't use it?
Well, I would say if nothing was used at trial, the issue wouldn't be presented at all.
I thought you had told me the violation occurred when the statements were taken.
No, that is correct. The officer should have ceased questioning at that point. At least we are not contesting that point. We did not raise it in the trial court, and we are not raising it here, trying to argue that
Well, it makes a difference analytically to know whether it is a violation of the Sixth Amendment when the testimony is offered at trial, or whether it's a violation of some prophylactic rule designed to protect Sixth Amendment rights. Which is it?
Well, the right counsel, with regard to custodial interrogation, it seems to me, can only ripen, if I can put it that way, when some evidence taken from the accused is offered in court. If the prosecutor had not used this statement in any way, then I would say that the Sixth Amendment right wasn't violated. Only a prophylactic rule to protect that right would have been violated
by
the
questioning. That's a rather curious position to take, I think. I would have thought that the Sixth Amendment was violated when the questions were asked. Then it becomes a question of what's the remedy for that violation.
Well, either the Sixth Amendment or a prophylactic rule would be violated when the questions were asked, I suspect. But it seems to me that in its essence, the Sixth Amendment is a trial right or a preparation for trial right, and if counsel is denied, as in Powell, an adequate time to prepare, or denied at trial, as in Gideon, you have a violation of the Sixth Amendment itself.
Suppose the district attorney himself or herself had conducted the questioning after appointment of counsel. and without a waiver, would that have been a violation of the Sixth Amendment? And let me tell you that the reason I ask the question is because there are many reasons why you may wish to interrogate a defendant other than simply to obtain evidence. You may want to see his or her demeanor, how they react to a certain line of questioning. And if you say there's no Sixth Amendment violation unless there's some evidence introduced, it seems to me that there would be many reasons why prosecutors would want to go down and talk to the people they're going to put on trial.
Well, again, I struggle with the question because it seemed to me that the Sixth Amendment was, in essence, a trial right. And, for example, I can see situations in the Fifth Amendment, if I could compare just for a moment, where an individual could even be coerced into giving a statement, but his Fifth Amendment right wouldn't be violated until the evidence is offered, because his right is not to be compelled to be a witness against himself.
But the language of the Fifth Amendment is different, of course.
That's correct.
It suggests that result. That's not the language of the Sixth Amendment.
Well, the Sixth Amendment, to me, does not suggest on its face any necessary role for counsel at interrogation prior to the attachment of the right. In the first portion of my brief, I attempted to argue or to make the point that there is at least some theoretical question as to the underpinning of the entire doctrine of counsel even having a role at this stage. I'm not planning to argue that point today, but all I wish to suggest there is that there is an argument to be made that perhaps this Court has taken the doctrine of the right to counsel at interrogation as far as it ought to go, so that it should not extend it to impeachment use. What I am suggesting here with the first portion of my argument as to the prophylactic rule is simply that Jackson is a prophylactic rule in terms of guarding the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and that there hasn't been a finding in this case by any court that the respondent didn't otherwise validly waive his right to counsel. The issue was never litigated in this case.
And the Michigan Court of Appeals relied on Jackson for its holding?
Yes, it did. On appeal, what the Michigan Court of Appeals stated was that and I quote, that the statement was made in violation of defendant's Sixth Amendment right to counsel, CEG Michigan v. Jackson. A statement so acquired may not be used for any purpose, including impeachment, and that was the extent of the Court of Appeals analysis in this case. That court made no independent inquiry as to whether there had been an otherwise valid waiver of the right to counsel, and there was no need for it to do so because in Jackson this court had held that any waiver of the right to counsel occurring after its assertion and occurring at police-initiated interrogation is simply invalid. There is no need for further inquiry. That case, Michigan v. Jackson, was premised on Edwards v. Arizona and imported directly the Edwards rule that when an accused asserts his Miranda counsel right to cut off questioning, any waiver occurring subsequently at police-initiated interrogation is simply invalid without any further inquiry into the manner in which that waiver might have occurred. But I would submit that.
But you just, I was trying to remember this sequence. This was not only after he'd been, this particular questioning, was it after he'd been both charged and after a lawyer had been appointed?
Yes, this was after arraignment and assertion of the right to counsel by claim of indigency and the appointment of counsel.
So the prosecutor and the police knew he was represented and he had a lawyer that they could contact.
I'm sure the police were undoubtedly aware of that. I can't say this individual officer was that he said he wanted to talk to, but that's, when he said, I don't know if I should talk to my lawyer, that's pretty well told him, I think.
Do you think the case would be any different? I was just thinking of Justice Kennedy's question. If the questioning had been by the prosecutor?
As to the Sixth Amendment, I don't think it would make a difference, but I think we'd be into a different question in the state of Michigan as to the application of the ethical standards.
It'd be clearly unethical, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
It's not unethical for the prosecutor to use an agent to do it, is that right?
Well, if the prosecutor used an agent, that is, told the police officer to go talk to him, I think that would also be unethical. The canons say a lawyer cannot communicate or cause another. But the prosecutor did not tell this officer to talk to the individual. In fact, he did not know this was going on.
You think the case would be different if the prosecutor had told the police officer to go ahead and see what you can find out?
Under the canons, I think definitely it would.
How about constitutionally?
No, I don't think it would be different constitutionally. But I think we would not be here because of the canons and the way Michigan has construed those.
But going back again to the constitutional question, you think it would not be a constitutional violation for the prosecutor himself or herself to go ahead and question that?
I don't think the constitutional question would turn on who does the asking.
I don't understand why you say that the case wouldn't be here because of the violation of the canons. Do we exclude evidence because of violation of the canons now?
Well, no, I think if the Michigan Supreme Court or Court of Appeals had said this case is reversed because we find as a matter of state law that a violation of the canons precludes use of the evidence for any purpose, then I think the case would have been decided on a state law basis and we wouldn't have a federal ground to go on. This court has recognized that in the Edwards context, that the court there was not dealing with a constitutional rule. In Solem v. Stooms, this court said, in declining to afford Edwards retroactive effect, that the court in Edwards had created a protective umbrella serving to enhance the constitutional guarantee and referred to the rule in Edwards as a prophylactic rule. The court stated that Edwards established a bright-line rule to safeguard pre-existing rights, not a new substantive requirement. So is it possible to violate a protective rule to, as it were, pierce the protective umbrella without violating the underlying constitutional principle that the protective rule or umbrella was designed to protect? And I think this court has answered that question in the affirmative on more than one occasion. For example, in Miranda, this court has held time and again that the Miranda warnings themselves are not constitutional rights, but are prophylactic rules designed to protect the underlying constitutional right, that of a compelled self-incrimination.
Well, counsel, if you take the position that the violation of the Sixth Amendment occurs at the time the evidence is offered at trial, then it seems to me very difficult to argue that it's only a prophylactic rule. Then you're dealing with the violation itself. If you took the position that the violation occurred when the questioning occurred, then I can understand that you could have a prophylactic rule that says you won't use it at trial. But I find your argument hard to follow.
No, I think Your Honor is correct, and I see your point. I'm tending to confuse the Sixth and the Fifth Amendments. I think that if error occurred in the constitutional sense, whether it be a prophylactic rule or the underlying right, it would have to occur at questioning. The admission of the evidence is a question of whether or not any remedy springs or not. If it's not admitted, no remedy springs. If it is, then there's a litigable point. So I think Your Honor is correct.
But, counsel, is it not possible that there's a constitutional violation at both times? That A, it's a constitutional violation to engage in this kind of questioning when the man is represented by counsel, and B, it's a constitutional violation to introduce it at trial. You seem to think the second was the case just very, very naturally. I don't think they're necessarily inconsistent with one another.
Well, I think, for example, it's conceivable that the individual could be questioned and then no prosecution brought or the case dropped. I can see the point.
Not after he's been indicted. Do you think a police officer would come back and say, I've just asked him some questions. He says he's innocent, so we'll drop the
No, I don't think so, but new evidence might be uncovered, for example, pointing in another direction, or somebody else might confess and the charges could be dropped. Charges have been dropped up to and including during trial in cases. It's conceivable it could happen, and the evidence never be offered. I suspect I would not say, given Justice O'Connor's questions, I think she's correct that I couldn't say that means no violation that ever occurred when the questioning occurred previously. It simply didn't ripen into anything that one would litigate.
It's also true that if you acknowledge a violation occurred at that time, then it's quite different from the Miranda situation, which the warning is given in order to avoid a violation.
Well, but I'm not conceding that what was violated in this case was the Constitution at the questioning. I'm not conceding that there was not a valid waiver of the right to counsel. I'm conceding that Michigan v. Jackson was violated. And the question
What is Michigan v. Jackson? I don't understand that.
Well, Michigan v. Jackson states that if the individual has asserted his right to counsel, the police simply may not initiate any questioning with him unless he goes forward first, which is the precise rule of Edwards transposed from the Fifth Amendment into the Sixth Amendment. The rule of Edwards is if the individual exercises his Miranda counsel right, he can't be interrogated again unless he initiates. It's the same rule from the Fifth into the Sixth. And this court has said in the Edwards context that that's a prophylactic rule designed to protect voluntariness.
To avoid constitutional violations.
That's correct.
Here you're saying a constitutional violation has occurred.
No, I'm saying a Jackson violation has occurred. What I am conceding in this case is that this was not an initiation by the defendant. And I'm conceding that simply because of the colloquy that occurred between the police officer.
I think you've changed your position from your answer to Justice O'Connor, which was that a constitutional violation occurred at the time of the
questioning. Well, let me try to make clear. The violation that occurred in this case occurred at the time of the questioning is what I'm now conceding to Justice O'Connor. But I'm not conceding that that was a violation of the Sixth Amendment, because that question has really never been litigated. All that was decided was that Jackson was violated. And what I'm arguing to this Court today in the first portion of my argument is that Jackson establishes a prophylactic rule to protect waivers of counsel, so that if an individual has asserted his right to counsel, you just can't question him at all. But I think that it is certainly conceivable and possible that if the police do initiate interrogation after the assertion of the right to counsel, and we examined all the surrounding facts, that one could say as a matter of actual fact that a voluntary and intelligent and knowing waiver of the right to counsel has occurred. If that can occur, if it is possible to actually voluntarily, knowingly, intelligently waive the right to counsel when the police initiate the interrogation, then the rule prohibiting that must be a prophylactic rule designed to protect and ensure and enhance that guarantee, just as in the Edwards context it's to protect.
What if, taking Justice Kennedy's example, the police had taken him up into the courtroom and set him on the witness stand with nobody there except the prosecutor and the police, and said, "We'd just like to ask you a few questions." And he says, "I don't know whether I should or not, and maybe I ought to talk to my lawyer." And anyway, they go ahead and ask him the questions, and he goes ahead and answers them, says, I will do it. They want to see how he performs on the stand. Would that itself violate a constitutional right, do you think? Do you think he had a right to have a lawyer with him in that proceeding?
In other words, if everything that occurred here, it occurred but in a different setting. In a
courtroom, and the prosecutor himself or herself present, and they say, we may not want to use this evidence. We just want to see how you respond to questions in a courtroom.
Well, I think it may well be in those circumstances, and it may
question,
well be.
Would he have a right to have a – could they do that without having a lawyer with him?
Well, again, if he validly and intelligently and knowingly waived his right to counsel, I don't think the Sixth Amendment would be violated, and it would turn on the facts of each case. Initiating the contact at all would violate Jackson. But it's possible that after that initiation, he may meet a Johnson v. Zerp standard or any other standard for waiver. In this case, that was never litigated because below, the respondent or defense counsel at trial, who was not Mr. Morgan, did not object to the use of this statement for impeachment purposes, and therefore, there was never any record developed as to what happened in terms of any warning, how the defendant came to speak. That was never fully explored, because all that mattered was, to the Michigan Court of Appeals, was that Jackson was violated because they treated this as police-initiated interrogation.
And they ruled that notwithstanding the failure to object to its use in the trial court, they would reach it and reverse the conviction.
That's correct. The Michigan Court of Appeals did three things. They forgave the failure to object. They found a Jackson violation and said that a Jackson violative statement cannot be used for impeachment, and they held that this was not harmless error. Now, I think as to one and three, as to forgiving the failure to object and a finding of a lack of harmless error, that the court erred egregiously, but they held what they held, and because they held in the way they held, we are here on the second issue with a rather scant record, because the issue was never developed in the trial court due to the failure to object.
Has Messiah got anything to do with this case?
Well, if there were a Sixth Amendment violation in this case, then it would be a violation of Messiah.
Is Messiah relevant to deciding whether there was a Sixth Amendment violation?
I don't think, absent Michigan v. Jackson, what occurred here would necessarily be a Messiah violation. The question would be,
why not?
Because the question would be, which has never been resolved, did the respondent validly waive his right to counsel when the police initiated the interrogation? And until Jackson, this court had not said the police can't initiate. In Messiah, Brewer v. Williams, there was initiated interrogation by the police, but what divided this court was whether there was an appropriate waiver, not that the police had initiated the contact. That was not the concern of the court in those cases, but it was in Michigan v. Jackson.
Yeah, but there was a concern that they had a lawyer.
Yes, there was a concern that he had a lawyer, and there was a Sixth Amendment violation found because the right had attached, and the court held it wasn't validly waived. It was the waiver question that divided the court in those cases. Did he waive it or not? Not that he couldn't be approached, but that he didn't waive counsel when he was approached. And that question, did he waive counsel?
But if he didn't waive it, but absent waiver, there was a Sixth Amendment violation just from the questioning.
That's true, absent waiver. And I'm simply saying that waiver question has never really been explored in this case, because if you find a Jackson violation, that's the end of the analysis. Mm-hmm. You have to find an initiation.
Didn't Messiah have an element of surreptitiousness to it on the part of the government?
In Messiah, the Messiah did not realize that he was speaking to a government agent, Colson, who was in the car and wearing a wire, as I recall.
So just answering the questions didn't amount to a waiver.
That's correct. He didn't know he was speaking to a government agent, so he couldn't very well waive his right to counsel.
Was there any doubt here that the defendant knew he was speaking to a police officer?
Oh no, none whatsoever. As I said, the first part of my argument was simply that this Court should not find that exclusion of evidence for impeachment purposes is required when a prophylactic rule has been violated, and I tried to urge that Jackson is such a rule. But more fundamentally, if this Court were to determine that what happened here was a violation of the Sixth Amendment as well, we would also urge that this Court not hold that exclusion of the evidence for impeachment purposes is required. This Court has considered the question of impeachment use of evidence when it has been obtained in violation of a constitutional principle rather than a prophylactic rule with regard to two amendments, the Fourth and the Fifth. And this Court has reached different conclusions with regard to the remedy, depending on which amendment is involved, and we submit for good reason. With the Fifth Amendment, this Court has held that statements which are compelled are admissible for no purpose whatsoever. Even those cases allowing impeachment use of evidence obtained in violation of one of the Miranda prophylactic rules recognize that if those statements are also compelled and therefore taken in violation of the Fifth Amendment and not simply the prophylactic rule, then no use may be made of those statements.
A defendant who's been given counsel and the police know he's got counsel, you think there's no violation of the Sixth Amendment if the police go to him and ask if he would like to waive his right to counsel and talk?
That's correct. I think that's not a violation of the Sixth Amendment necessarily. We'd look at
all
the
facts. You don't think it's a violation of the Sixth Amendment when the defendant has counsel for the police or the prosecution to approach the defendant?
Again, not necessarily. Looking to Messiah and Brewer, where this Court was split, I believe, 5-4 in both cases, the Court focused on the facts. Was there a waiver? Not that there couldn't be a waiver, but was there a waiver? And I think that as to whether the Sixth Amendment was violated, that's what this Court would have to focus on. And if in this case it was found that there is a Sixth Amendment violation, again, I would say that impeachment use should be allowed.
Excuse me. In theory, how could we have declared this unlawful if it was not a Sixth Amendment violation? I mean, it's very nice. You're drawing a line between a Sixth Amendment violation and a prophylactic rule, but the prophylactic rule is enunciated by saying, well, you know, the core of the Sixth Amendment is just this, but in order to protect that core, we're going to say that a Sixth Amendment violation constitutes this greater body of activity.
Well, I don't know if that's exactly what this Court has done, because if, again, you look to the Fifth Amendment, this Court has said the core is this, compelled self-incrimination. And here are some rules, prophylactic rules, to protect that core. And if these are violated, you can't use the evidence in the case in chief, even if this isn't violated.
Of course, if there would be a Sixth Amendment violation just by the police approaching him, Jackson wouldn't have been necessary, I suppose.
That's correct. I think that's true. This Court could have said in Messiah or Brewer or other cases that the police approach rendered any waiver involuntary or was impermissible, and you would not have gotten into the splits in the Court in those cases as to whether or not the waiver had occurred. They would have been very easy cases to decide, I believe. In Portage, this Court held that the Fifth Amendment violation is admissible for no purpose whatsoever, and that principle did not turn on whether or not the statement might be reliable, because there the compulsion was a judicial order rather than physical force. But in reversing the lower court, this Court said that the linchpin of the Fifth Amendment is not reliability, it's coercion. So any coerced statements by a governmental agent simply cannot be used for any purpose whatsoever, because, as Justice Stewart put it, in that case the Court was dealing with the constitutional privilege in its most pristine form. That's what the Fifth Amendment is for. It's to exclude from evidence, a class of testimonial evidence, compelled statements. That's why it exists. But with the Fourth Amendment, as contrasted to the Fifth, this Court's reached a different result. This Court has held that when that right is violated, rather than a prophylactic rule designed to protect it, and I'm unaware of any, frankly, that use of evidence for impeachment purposes illegally seized under the Fourth Amendment is permissible. Beginning 35 years ago in Walder, this Court has consistently held to that proposition, recognizing that arriving at the truth is the fundamental goal of our system of justice, and that full cross-examination is, as Wigmore has said, the greatest legal engine ever invented.
Counsel, I thought there was some evidence in this case that the defendant himself told a police officer he'd like to make another statement.
That's correct. There is.
But you appear to concede that the police approached him. Did you mean to do that?
No, what I'm conceding is, because we conceded it in the trial court, and is that when the defendant stated, I'd like to make another statement, and then said, I don't know if I should talk to my lawyer or not, and the officer said, well, you don't need to because we'll give him the statement, that should not be treated as initiated by the defendant, that his remark turned it into initiated interrogation by the police because of his rather ambiguous remark about counsel. The trial prosecutor conceded that's why she wouldn't use it in your case in chief, and I'm not disputing here that this should not be treated as the police that this should be treated as police initiated interrogation.
Well, if we adopt your rule, what's to prevent the police from just dropping by the jail cell every morning and saying, would you like to talk to us today?
Well, I would submit that certainly abusive police conduct shouldn't be allowed. And there is a question.
Is it abusive? They just drop by every morning because there's no deterrent under your rule, as I see it.
Well, I think the deterrent is any evidence so gained can't be used in the case in chief.
They don't have that evidence anyway, by hypothesis. There's no downside, in other words.
Well, there is.
As far as the defendant is concerned, they're finished with him the minute he has counsel. But under your rule, they might as well have the evidence for impeachment. That's better than no evidence at all.
Very unsanitary prophylactic rule, in other words.
This court faced this very same question in Haas. In Haas, what happened was the individual was given his Miranda right to counsel and asked for a lawyer. And the police kept questioning. And a statement was taken. And this court said expressly, one might concede that when proper Miranda warnings have been given and the officer then continues his interrogation after the suspect asks for an attorney, which I submit is analogous to what Your Honor is suggesting, the officer may be said to have little to lose and perhaps something to gain by way of uncovering possibly impeachment material. This speculative possibility, however, is even greater where the warnings are defective and the defect is not known to the officer. In any event, the balance was struck in Harris, and we are not disposed to change it now. I would submit that the instant situation is really almost perfectly analogous to what happened in Haas. Request for counsel, interrogation continued. Here we're suggesting
the
request
counsel hadn't attached.
That's correct. One is a Fifth Amendment and one is a Sixth Amendment, but as to
one
deterrence.
One is not a Fifth Amendment, one is a prophylactic, according to you, at least a prophylactic rule designed to avoid Fifth Amendment violation.
That's
the other
correct.
Is a consummated Sixth Amendment violation.
That's true, but as to the deterrent effect on the police on exclusion of impeachment evidence, I believe the situations are analogous. The police don't want to get evidence illegally. They're not out there trying to violate all constitutional principles. And there is a concern that they might get a statement that would be otherwise admissible, and now they can't use it. They might get evidence a statement which they derive evidence from, and they get into a fruit of the poisonous tree analysis. The police aren't trying to violate the Constitution. There is a good deterrence rationale on excluding it in the case in chief, and I think this Court's remark in Haas that it's speculative as to whether there's an increased effect if you exclude it for impeachment use is valid here. Haas was decided 15 years ago, and I've seen nothing in the literature and nothing has been suggested in respondents.
Mr. Baumann, don't you recognize that there is, even under your ethical standards you referred to earlier about the prosecutor, if the right had not attached, the prosecutor could go ahead and interrogate the suspect, couldn't he?
Yes.
There wouldn't be any ethical violation then, but apparently under Michigan law, there's a very sharp distinction between the relationship that arises once a man is charged and has a lawyer. Different, but it's a different ballgame.
Yes. But I
You think it shouldn't be, though?
I think the deterrent principle as to whether or not there's any deterrence gained or it's significant enough to warrant the detraction from the truth-finding process that happens when you exclude the evidence for impeachment purposes is simply the same in this situation as it is in Haas. Again, I've seen nothing to suggest that since Haas, police routinely continue to interrogate people after they assert their Miranda right to counsel. And it's been 15 years. I suspect if one were to say that Haas had opened the floodgates to illegal police behavior, that we might have heard about it by now. And I think that translates to the situation also, where we would see the same sort of situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baughman. Mr. Morgan.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Respondent submits that this case involves the essence, the absolute, unqualified essence of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. There's no question the right had attached. Respondent was formally charged. There's no question that he asserted that right. He requested an attorney. That attorney then stood as the medium, as this Court has indicated in Jackson, between the state and the respondent for all contacts. There is no question then, notwithstanding that medium, notwithstanding that assertion of the right to counsel, the state interfered with that right. The state interfered conceitedly, deliberately.
When did the violation occur?
The violation occurred both, Justice Connor.
O'Connor,
I'm sorry, Justice. At the time of the interference, but I don't think that ends the analysis. I think the next step is to look to see, is there prejudice? Or in other words, did the state gain some advantage? Did the state use it? And not just use it in the sense of, as the Solicitor General argued in the amicus brief, that, well, they only used it, in essence, to generate impeachment, and that's not so bad. Well, there are many uses. The example of put the respondent in the witness chair and ask him a few questions and size him up is a use which is to the state's advantage.
Can the defendant waive his Sixth Amendment right to counsel?
A defendant can waive his Sixth Amendment right, certainly. But after assertion of the right, then it is respondent's position that counsel has some role in that waiver. And I think that's the essential notion that was contained in Michigan.
I gather, of whether the defendant waived his right.
There's, and I don't think there could be, frankly. The record is insufficient.
You don't think the court could have made that determination?
No, not on the record, because the state also concedes, they concede a Sixth Amendment violation, they concede a Miranda defective admonition. And by virtue of that, then, I think implicitly, there cannot be a waiver of the Sixth Amendment right. But it is, the violation may occur at the time of interference by the state, but it is then, the next step is prejudice. Was there some use? Did the state gain an advantage? You could have a violation, no question, a Sixth Amendment violation, but no prejudice to defendant, no use. Weatherford versus Bercy, albeit in a civil context, is an example. Undercover officer, acting undercover, posing as a defendant, intruding in the attorney-client relationship and intruding in the defense camp. But, of course, the court said certainly there was a violation, but there was no prejudice because the officer never shared anything he learned with the prosecutor. Consequently, there was no prejudice. There was no use. But there are many ways in which the state can engage in a Sixth Amendment violation here and gain an advantage.
Well,
or
wouldn't,
prejudice
it, wouldn't, to wouldn't your argument be just as strong if it were just an Edwards violation?
No, I don't believe so.
Well, the police would have every the same possible urge to go ahead and question, knowing that they could use the forbidden statements for impeachment.
Well, I think
they would also find out how he responds to questions, what his demeanor is.
I think, though, Edwards involves a prophylactic rule. Here we're talking about the substantive constitutional amendment.
That's just a difference in language as far as the possible advantage to the state is concerned.
Oh, it's a critical difference in language, because in Edwards, certainly there had been no assertion of the right to counsel. Edwards is a prophylactic rule, which
Edwards to take a hold at all, there has to be an assertion of the right to counsel. after an assertion, you can't go, the police can't go back to him.
But in Edwards, I believe it was an assertion of right to counsel in a Fifth Amendment context.
Well, I know, but, some police, would say, but the right certainly attached then that he had a right to counsel under the Fifth Amendment for a lawyer to be there, and the police weren't supposed to talk to him. They went ahead and talked to him.
The right to counsel in that context attached. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel, to have the lawyer serve as the medium for all contacts between the state and the defendant, had not attached. There are many uses.
Well, are you saying that the police could not approach a defendant after he has perhaps been assigned counsel and asked him if he wanted to make a statement, and the defendant could not waive that right?
That, we submit, is the essence of the court's holding in Michigan v. Jackson.
That's not a prophylactic rule. You say that is core Sixth Amendment.
That is core Sixth Amendment.
How do you get that from the text? I mean, the text says you're entitled to counsel. Yeah. Where does the... How is it the core that since you're entitled to counsel, you can't even approach somebody who has counsel and say, would you waive your right to counsel? How can you possibly consider that the core rather than prophylactic?
Well, because you're approaching the defendant in the context of the adversarial process. You're approaching the defendant at a time where, after the defendant has asserted that right, and by asserting that right has said, I realize I cannot deal with the state. I am incapable of dealing with the state. That's what the assertion of the right to counsel means.
No, I don't think it means that at all. It seems to me that's a prophylactic rule. The assertion of the right to counsel is, I am entitled to deal with the state through counsel. That's what the Sixth Amendment requires. But I'm certainly free to waive that. Now, as a prophylactic rule, we've said you can't even ask for a waiver. But I don't see how the fact that you can't even ask for a waiver is the core of the Sixth Amendment. You really think that's not prophylactic?
No, it is the presence of counsel at that critical stage which is the core of the Sixth Amendment. Counsel should be there at the time the state approaches the defendant and asks him to seek to waive his right.
That's the core.
Yet a counsel defendant can approach the police and tell them, I want to make a statement.
In Michigan v. Jackson, the court makes repeated reference to police initiated.
Yes.
In this case, though, the state concedes that Michigan v. Jackson is implicated.
I thought your position was this right simply could not be waived once it attached. And yet, certainly nothing in Michigan against Jackson holds that a counsel defendant cannot, on himself, go to the police and say, look, I want to tell you something.
But I think the thrust of Jackson is that waiver in that context must be an exacting waiver. And the court speaks of Johnson versus Zerps. Certainly, there's nothing to prevent a defendant from pleading guilty in a case, but we would not countenance a plea proceeding where the defendant...
Well, I'm not talking about a plea proceeding. The guy's in a jail cell, and he says to somebody that comes by, I want to talk to the police. And the police come, and he says, I know that I have a lawyer, I have a right to a lawyer, I have a right not to say anything at all. I've considered all that, and I want to say something to you.
And it raises a troubling contradiction.
What's the contradiction?
The notion that contained in Jackson that in spite of full, complete Miranda warnings, in spite of the fact that Jackson evidently made a voluntary statement, in spite of the fact that he made that statement knowingly, intelligently, a voluntary statement in compliance with Miranda, the court still held that because the right to counsel had attached, that waiver was not sufficient.
Yes, but the facts in Michigan against Jackson were that the police had initiated the thing. Well, what I'm positing to you is that totally initiated by the defendant. Your position is like what Justice Frankfurter criticized in Adams against McCann. You imprison the defendant in his rights.
Well, the defendant is always free to forego the right to counsel.
And then in my example, he's free to go to the police or ask the police, tell them, I want to make a statement. The police are free to receive that statement. Is that correct?
Respondent's position would be that the police have an obligation to provide notice to the defendant's counsel.
What case do you rely on for that?
We rely, in essence, on our reading of Michigan v. Jackson.
Does Jackson say that?
Well, it says that there was no valid waiver. What is the difference if it's police-initiated or defendant-initiated? The court...
Then our Edwards decision and our Michigan against Jackson decision really make little sense, because I thought both of those turned on the idea that there's a critical difference whether it's police-initiated or defendant-initiated.
But this court in Henry, for example, said that within a Sixth Amendment context, it is irrelevant who initiated the contact.
An element of surreptitiousness that you also had in Messiah.
Yes, sir.
Assuming there's a violation of the Sixth Amendment somewhere in this process, you started to argue about why the statement that was taken could not be used for impeachment. And why is that? Why is this case different from our Walder and that the Fourth Amendment cases and the Miranda cases?
Because the analogy to the Fourth Amendment is simply inappropriate. The Fourth Amendment is a right that all citizens have. It is not a procedural right, such as the Sixth Amendment. It does not extend to the integrity of the trial process. It does not encompass the essential components of the right to counsel, notions of trustworthiness, notions of reliability. The Fourth Amendment, the harm is complete at the time that it's done. It simply is an inappropriate analogy to a core violation of the Sixth Amendment.
Well, what's the difference between this and the Miranda Edwards situation?
Because Miranda also, as a prophylactic rule, is just that, judicially crafted as the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule, designed as an outer layer of protection, not involving a direct violation of the constitutional amendment itself.
Yeah, but in terms of the theory of our cases, allowing the use of this illegally taken evidence for impeachment, I don't see why the rationale of those cases, or maybe you can tell me why the rationale of those cases doesn't apply here.
Because
the defendant is testifying on the stand, and he testifies quite contrary to some statement he made to the police.
Of course, here it was not quite contrary.
But if it were, your argument would cover that like a blanket.
My argument would cover
that
as well, because in essence what I think the state is asking the court to do is to look through the wrong end of the telescope, to focus solely on the truth-seeking function to the exclusion of the larger context. And the larger context is that this was an interrogation in violation of the right to counsel.
Do you think the balance should come out differently?
There should be no balancing at all. And that is our position, that this is in the larger context of it's as much an adversarial proceeding in private as the trial may be. It may be as critical or more critical than the trial. The need for the presence of counsel is just as critical. The state argues that, well, the role of counsel in essence is it's limited to the trial courtroom. It really doesn't come into play. But to borrow a phrase from a well-known congressional investigation, the lawyer is not a potted plant. The lawyer plays a role at that kind of interrogation. The lawyer's role is to ensure that the questions are fairly stated. More importantly, the lawyer's role is to ensure that the client comprehends the questions.
But if Michigan against Jackson is a prophylactic rule, then presumably we would get into a little balancing to determine if that's violated, whether the evidence can be used for impeachment.
Assuming Michigan v. Jackson is prophylactic, it's respondents' position that here there was not only a violation of the prophylactic rule as conceded by the state, but also a substantive violation of the Sixth Amendment itself. And because there was a violation of the Sixth Amendment, we don't get into that balancing.
But that's not what the Michigan Court of Appeals held. They cited Michigan against Jackson, as I recall, and only Michigan against Jackson.
That's correct. They cited also People versus Gagneau, but that is not a case that rests on state grounds. That was a plurality opinion, three justices basing their opinion on the state constitution, three justices dissenting, saying that use of the state grounds was a pretext to evade review here, and the seventh saying the Sixth Amendment.
Sounds like our court, yeah.
Mr. Morgan, you gave us a litany about what the lawyer's role is. The lawyer's role is to do this, and the lawyer's role is to do that. I guess what this case involves is whether, or at least the issue of whether it's a core Sixth Amendment violation, involves the issue of whether the lawyer's role is to assist the defendant in deciding whether he wants a lawyer. I don't think it necessarily follows that just because the lawyer's role is to defend against all sorts of other things, it is also the lawyer's role to necessarily the lawyer's role to assist the defendant in deciding whether he wants to waive his right to a lawyer. One can certainly say that that's an entirely different question from other aspects of a lawyer's role.
Well, that is the troubling contradiction that I fumbled badly previously. And the contradiction is, I believe, the defendant who asserts the right implicitly, explicitly, evidences his knowing decision that he is incapable to deal with the state. After making that decision, which no one can contest is knowing and intelligent, it's troubling, then, to have the same defendant, if you will, who has already recognized that he is incapable of dealing with the state, go to the state, deal with the state, or in this instance, subject himself to the guiding hand of police officers.
He later recognizes he was wrong. You're saying he has just given away his free will somehow, can no longer take it back. He can only speak through a lawyer thereafter. I don't know any other area of the law where we say a person can somehow contract away his right to contract. That can't be contracted away.
Mr. Morgan, what about the Feretta context? Do you think the lawyer plays a role in the judge's decision on whether to let the accused represent himself throughout the trial?
I think the lawyer plays a role, and ultimately the police don't decide waiver. The court decides waiver. And that's our position here, is after assertion of the right to counsel, there must be an exacting standard if we're going to get into the question of waiver. Comparable. In Feretta, the court not only ascertained from the defendant that he knew what he was doing, that he wanted to do that. The court not only ascertained and informed the defendant that there were detriments. The court in Feretta actually, the trial judge actually went beyond that, said this is a real bad idea. That's the kind of waiver that respondent submits, that's the kind of exacting waiver that respondent submits is the only permissible waiver of right to counsel after the defendant has asserted the right. What the state seeks, frankly, is license to interrogate the defendant Here it was 6 days before trial. There's no restriction in the state's position. So if it's unsuccessful, 6 days before trial, let them go 5 days, 4 days, 3 days, 2 days. Let them go to the defendant during the trial itself. There is absolutely no downside for the police. That's why deterrence really has no...
But the only upside they're asserting is to prevent the defendant from perjuring himself. That's the only upside that they're asserting. And if you assume this is a prophylactic rule, certainly one of the things in the balance is what's at the other end? Is it the introduction of initial testimony, or is it rather simply the state preventing perjury from occurring by impeaching the defendant with his contrary statements?
In engaging in the offending interrogation, I would not attribute the motive of preventing perjury to the state, frankly. The state is obviously engaging in something that, number one, generates impeachment material, number two, constitutes a form of discovery that they were not otherwise entitled to, number three, may actually undermine the integrity of the process and inhibit the truth-seeking. For example, if in this context the police had taken Respondent Harvey's statement 6 days before trial in violation of his right to counsel and shared it with the complainant, and the complainant then used it consciously or unconsciously to prepare herself for testimony, to perhaps consciously or unconsciously to shape her testimony, to steel herself for cross-examination, then this offending interrogation has actually undermined respondent's right of confrontation.
We'd have a different question before us. The only question we have before us here is whether it can be used to counteract what appears to be perjury at the trial.
In this record, it does not appear to be perjury. It barely appears to be inconsistent. But respondent's position in essence is that just as we do not permit a compelled, involuntary statement as in Portash, to be used for impeachment, we should not permit, in the name of truth-seeking, a statement taken in clear violation of the right to counsel, that we do not simply engage in that kind of balancing, truth-seeking versus deterrence.
Part of the reason for the Fifth Amendment rule in cases like Portash has been a feeling on the part of the court, hasn't it, that compelled testimony has an element of unreliability to it?
I don't know if it was ever suggested, frankly, in Portash, who was compelled by virtue of an order to testify before a grand jury under oath.
So you would distinguish that from cases where there's a suspicion of coercion, of a physical coercion?
They're obviously distinguishable, but both come within the rule that the government or the state cannot use that product to impeach the defendant because it would violate the Fifth Amendment right itself.
But it hasn't, at least in the coerced confession cases, part of the reasoning there has been that the coerced confession is deemed presumptively unreliable.
That's correct.
And certainly that wouldn't be true in this case. The circumstances attending the defendant's statement here would not lead to any presumption of unreliability.
I don't know if it would lead to a presumption of unreliability, but the record in this case implicates or raises a concern for unreliability. For example, the three areas of impeachment. One of the areas was you didn't tell the police the name of this person whose name, in essence, is now uttered in your testimony. Yes, I did tell them, respondent testifies. Yes, I told them. Not an answer that is patently perjurious, not an answer that is even contradicted in any fashion because the prosecutor never completes the impeachment process. The prosecutor instead, in this truth-seeking adventure, as the state uses the term, insinuates, well, if it's not in there, that's the police.
Well, but the Michigan Court of Appeals treated this as impeachment, didn't it?
They didn't say
it's not proper impeachment under our law. They say under the federal constitution you can't use it.
But my point is the presence of counsel at that interrogation might have ensured that when respondent told the officer the name, it got into the statement. And that involves, I think, the area of reliability, certainly. There really is no downside for the state or in this instance, the police, and the state concedes, certainly, that the police in this instance are acting as agents of the prosecutor. There's no downside whatsoever to keep coming back at the defendant. And, of course, those defendants that are already in the custody of the state that confines them, that feeds them, and so forth, are probably the most vulnerable. And under the rule that the state seeks here, they seek a license to engage in that process not only repeatedly, not only as often as they like, but during the very trial process itself.
Of course, you say it's a constitutional violation even if the police are not trying to prompt this statement by the defendant. It's your position, as I understand it, that even if he's there at the cell door banging with his cup on the bars saying, I want to confess, the police say, I'm sorry, your lawyer's not here. We can't reach him. You'll have to wait till tomorrow.
That's my position. And if the respondent says, I want to confess, he can go to confess in open court where there is an exacting standard concerning that waiver, an exacting standard concerning all of the rights, and that's in compliance with
his
rule.
His will 11. By the Sixth Amendment has just been taken over and given to the lawyer. He says, I've talked to my minister. I've decided that the decent thing to do is to confess. I'm sorry, your lawyer has your will now. You can't do this.
Well, if that's his will overbear the lawyer, certainly. Where is the harm? Why is it wrong that the state says, no, you've already told us that you can't deal with us. You've already told us that you're incapable of dealing with us. Absolutely. But you have an attorney, and we're going to provide your attorney notice. And since you have a will, and it's independent, your will can overbear that of the attorney, just as Ferretta's will went out, and he was permitted to represent himself.
Counsel, in Michigan, I take it the rule is that it's unethical for defense counsel to knowingly introduce a line of perjured testimony?
That's correct.
What would happen if the police, after the appointment of counsel, took a statement, gave it to the counsel, and it was quite clear from the statement, because it linked up with other evidence, that the client's original story he told to the police was perjured testimony. What would the attorney's obligation be in that regard?
I think then we've implicated the court's ruling in Nix versus Whiteside.
In other words, the defense counsel would have the obligation to take into consideration this statement?
If it is clear, certainly, that the client intends to perjure himself?
Yes.
I believe so.
Well, then why can't the court take it into account?
Because, well, on this record, of course, we don't have.
Well, I'm assuming the more difficult case.
You're assuming the most difficult case, and that is an absolutely clear, beyond contradiction,
yes.
Confession.
Isn't the answer to that that if everybody plays according to the rules and they show the statement to the lawyer will not put on the false testimony?
I believe so.
So that if they carried out your suggestion, the problem would be easily solved.
Absolutely. In fact,
instead of waiting in the bushes and letting them put it in and get caught in a trap, their duty is to show it to the lawyer, who then has a duty not to introduce the false testimony.
But it's paradoxical, is it not, that the defense counsel has almost a higher obligation than that of the court. The court can blindfold itself to knowingly perjured testimony, even though the defense attorney cannot.
The confession or statement in your hypothet certainly may be no different than the involuntary compelled testimony of Portash. But in order to preserve the right itself, we do not engage in that kind of balancing. In order to prevent a violation of the Sixth Amendment itself, we don't engage in that kind of balancing, the truth-seeking function versus deterrence. And in essence, in sum, it is respondent's position that there is no question in this case that his right to counsel was violated, that analogies or comparisons to the judicially crafted Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule or the judicially crafted prophylactic rules of Miranda and the other outer layer of Edwards simply are inappropriate where there is a core violation of the amendment itself. And the state throughout its brief excises reference to the sword, which I think the court referenced, the shield.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Your time has expired.
Yes,
Mr.
Sir.
Boffman, you have 1 minute remaining.
Just a quick factual point. We do not concede in this case that after the colloquy between the attorney and the police officer, improper Miranda warnings were given. What we concede is, because we conceded there, that that cannot be viewed as defendant-initiated interrogation. What happened after, in terms of any waiver or warnings, just hasn't been litigated in this case, and that's the only question I think that's before this court factually. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boffman. The case is submitted. We'll hear our